talk to me about your first motorcycle you ever owned.
Oh, great question. Well, I'll tell you what. The first time I learned how to ride a bike, I'll never forget it. I was about 4 years old, and I do remember this. And I didn't know how to pedal yet, but I would get up on the top of the hill and push myself down the hill, and I'd roll at gravity, and I'd fall. And I would do that, like, a lot. My first thought, the clearest thought I have is remembering going, how can I put a lawnmower engine on my bike? I clearly remember that. Now, fast forward to, this was 1979, 1980. And these are literally my earliest memories. Fast forward to 1987. 80. Jeez, if I remember correctly, 86. I inherited a 50cc or 49cc, technically, Japanese scooter, Honda Spree. That was my first bike that I, which is a Honda scooter, which you can rent them like anywhere, old school scooters. You see them on everywhere in the world. And I would jump that off of rocks. No helmet. And 40 miles an hour. 10 years old. So that's, then I quickly, after destroying that, moved up to a dirt bike, XR100. Then I moved up to another dirt bike. And at 16, now I've been riding dirt bikes for years at this point. I was quite good at it. And at 16, my father had, I don't know if you're going to remember this, but a Le Car. You ever hear of Le Car? By Renault.
No.
It was a French import. It was this garbage French import car. And I, while I may not be a sports ball guy, I am a car guy and a motorcycle engine guy. And garbage Renault car. My father was a postmaster, had a friend who wanted it and had an old motorcycle, street bike. And he traded that Le Car for me for my bike. So when a lot of kids had their first car as a car, my first gifted vehicle was a motorcycle. And I rode that year-round in Rhode Island. It didn't matter. Oh,
the weather, the cold.
3 feet of snow on the ground. Didn't matter. Snow, rain. I would keep changes of clothes in my locker.
Oh my gosh. You'd have to.
Jeans, underwear, right? Socks, t-shirts, sweaters, sweatshirts. Because I would get soaked on the way to school, or just disgusting on the way to school. I wake up, shower like a normal kid. You know, you get ready for school. I go to school. Mm-hmm. I go into the gym and I'd shower again and I get dressed for class. And I rode that motorcycle for, it was a Honda CB450 76 that I rode for 40 rather. I rode that for 2-3 years, and then I've been never nonstop ever since.
Wow. Great story.
Thank you.
Yeah, you see what I did there? I wanted to open this up with a little bit of a story. I mean, like, just it. let's figure out how to see, everyone's got a story. We'll talk about that actually a little bit. Adam and I just had done talking. Welcome to Demo Jockeys, everybody. Jack Cochran, your host with a host always with me, Adam DiTommaso. We just got done talking about the stories that stick. Adam and I diving into the book a little bit here. We're going to be doing more of that next week as well. But part of that, we're talking about sort of everyone's got a story. So I wanted to see, as we started off here, Adam, tell me, you got to have a story about your first bike. And that's funny.
You got me, Jack.
I love how your first thought was. I love how your first thought was, can I throw a lawnmower motor on my bike?
Oh, total first thought. Yeah, like that's, it's, I'm wearing a, ironically enough, this is actually the hat that I only wear typically. It's rare that I wear it outside of riding my motorcycle. Like, wow. I ride Kawasaki's, and it's a Kawasaki hat, and I'd wear a helmet now, but I, when I'm not wearing the helmet, I'm wearing this hat.
Gotta throw a hat on. No, I absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. Well, I did want to say, before we hop into our conversation real quick, so normally I say this at the end, but I want to say it at the beginning so that people can get out there. We do have a Slack community that, if you want to join conversation, want to talk about what's happening here, want to throw some comments. Also, we're going to be opening up the backstage. So if you want to join us in some of these recordings, chat with us while that's going on, you'll see the link in the Slack channel whenever we're live. So you're free to do that. But we'll talk about everything else later, Adam. Let's hop on into the conversation.
Absolutely. Let's get into it.
Adam, we read another book. We read another book on storytelling.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, diving right into the book, I really appreciated the overarching theme that everyone has a story or a series of stories that they can tell, which is something that that we tend to forget or not really remember. I think that the number of times I hear people say, you know, well, I don't really, you know, I don't really have a life that's worth stories being told about and stuff like that. But I mean, I think the biggest thing I took out of reading all these stories in the book that Kendra's talking about is even the most mundane stories to you can actually be a very useful story. It's going to connect with someone in some way if you just kind of learn how and where and when to tell that story.
No, I think that's a great point.
There are stories everywhere. There are literally every single person has a story to tell. And they don't even realize it half the time, I would bet. And I think this book really helped drive that fact home that there's a story everywhere. And really just kind of have to look at it for it. But the funny thing about this book that I really liked is it wasn't afraid to call out that a lot of stories can suck.
Yeah. Not every story. There's actually one story she was telling about a story when she told someone not to tell a story.
Yeah.
And it was specifically saying, like, well, then you shouldn't tell a story because it's a forced story or it's the wrong place and that's just not going to come across.
You know, it's tying it back to what this book is a point of is it's a business skill. And certainly with any business skill, there's a time and a place to do it. And sometimes a story about the fourth cocktail I had at a party may not be the best one to give. In a certain business context.
I had such a bad hangover. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Let me tell you about me trying to get over this hangover.
Yeah, I'm telling you this at the trade show booth. No.
Well, maybe it's a tale of warning for people at trade shows, right?
Well, that's a different context, though. That's a story that would stick in the right context.
In the right context, yeah. Yeah, and that was, I think, a lot of the book was figuring out why you're telling the story, what someone would want to be hearing. And also the big part of I got out of it is make sure that what you're telling within a story aligns to the action you want someone to take. There's a story that Kendra tells about someone who was giving a very inspirational speech to, it was to prospective donors. And I think it was the United Way or Salvation Army or something like that. And she had these stories, and everyone loves them. They're great stories, but she's like, they don't work. The reason they worked is because people wanted to volunteer. They weren't wanting to donate at the end of the story. And it's just because that story and the way it was framed in the context of that story wasn't driving the outcome, but making some tweaks, making some adjustments to who the story was about and how it was told, it was still the same story, but had the desired outcome, which is, I think, a piece of especially business storytelling that I have never focused on too much. I'm like, well, a story is a story. I'll tell the story.
Right. Well,
your story has to align it with what you want people to do after it. Otherwise, it's not actually a good story in that context.
Right. And that's actually really, really important because particularly as SEs, when we're doing demos, we get that question a lot, you know, make sure there's a story in your demo. What's the customer story? And to me, it always has to be relevant to the example that we're setting forth. So if I know if I have to give a customer story, well, what perspective? We have to break it down. And actually, one of the things I liked about this book is the breakdown of the storytelling framework, where you're going to get into the idea of, for example, breaking down the kind of the three parts of a modern story, which you could say are normal, the explosion, and then the new normal. So what do we mean by normal? That's what's happening every day. There's a great event in the story which turns around and introduces you to a new normal because you've been changed by the explosion. And there's a subtext under that in the value story of getting into what is your customer's problem? What pain are they experiencing? How do they feel? That's something I had never in a million years ever thought to ask myself is, how do they feel? I don't care how they feel. I could care less. I got to come up with a story. But it's funny, but in that own mindset, I've just created more work for myself and put myself in a negative way if I had just, well, appreciated the fact of how they felt about the situation they were in.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a part that we tend to forget, especially from a business storytelling perspective, is exactly that. How is this being received? Are people connecting with the right emotions from the story? Do they see themselves in it? Otherwise, it lands where I feel like most, especially sales stories, tend to land, which is generic, 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 made up by marketing stat, generic, generic, generic.
You just told 10 company stories.
I told every story slide in every company I've been in, which is problem had problem that we say is the Bain problem. They implemented our solution solving problem. Afterwards, they were happy. They solved X cost savings or X revenue because problem no longer there.
And ROI like, is 800 times more.
It's like not every that's not a story. That's just listing off a situation.
Right? Yeah.
And it's so generic because even if you've got a person's name in there, no one's connecting to that. No one's thinking, oh, Joe had a problem where his laptop would break every month. So he signed up for our monthly laptop rental service. And now his laptops don't break anymore.
Because he just
literally
one.
Put your product in there and you have probably the customer story you've been told to tell.
There, whenever folks, listeners, friends, fellow demo jockeys, whenever you're told to create that story, I mean, this is a great book to give you the idea of how to the building blocks you need to formulate that and what story you want to tell, whether it be a customer story, whether it be a founder story. And you read the book, you get into the breakdown of what all these parts mean. But I think when you're working in your stories, always think of it from that customer perspective. Make sure that your story is relevant to the audience. So if you're doing a project for that company, you're going to want to say, well, your customers do X, Y, and Z. Let's talk about the story of your customer and take them through that story and then address how you can affect every part of that story and make it better for them, if that makes sense. I believe it does. But that is a big takeaway that I pulled out of this book and just the simple fact that, hey, the story matters.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that emotion that someone is tied to, There is a good amount of time spent figuring out how to dial into that emotion. And something that I've known this before, but I feel like it was talked about beautifully, was that it's the specifics that are going to drive that emotional connection, right? If I say, you know, Joe had a problem. He was walking down the street. He slipped and fell. He needed to go to a hospital. He went to our hospital and he was cured. Mm-hmm. Right? All those things might be factual, but Joe was walking down. It was a cold winter day. You know, he was focusing on, you know, he had to get to this meeting. Like, you start to engage with the specifics. And they're the specifics that maybe someone listening is going to either identify with personally, or they're going to think of someone they know who was in that same situation. And they start to get emotionally invested in that normal. And that's a big part of what Kendra was talking about, is when you're setting up that normal explosion and back to normal, the beginning normal has to be so unassuming that it allows someone in some way to identify with the character. Much like the same way in a movie, that you don't start with usually, you know, something going terribly wrong immediately. Now, there are some times when that happens in movies, but it's done.
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, exactly. But even then, you're rewinding. You're winding back to when it was normal, right? And it's in the normal that you start to identify with the person or relate to them, maybe, or maybe not. Or you start to get invested. And a lot of our value stories, a lot of the things where we're trying to talk about this bad, good, we forget that the initial normal has to be relatable. And it has to have the specifics that are going to make someone realize, this isn't just made up name doing made up activity for the purpose of my story. This is a real person. Even if the specifics are made up, that's what's going to give it the sense of emotional connection. That's going to really turn around the impact of that explosion and back to normal.
Well, it's funny. Yeah. And that's really what chapter 3 gets into, what makes a story great. You know, everything beats puppies and supermodels every time. The idea of, and I had a quick little joke from the book, because she gets into a great story about what happened at a particular Super Bowl party for her, you know, the Seahawks and the Denver Broncos, how it was horrible for gamblers. I don't, folks, little secret about me, I don't gamble or watch football. Sports ball is not a thing I do. I am just throwing it out there. It's funny.
How did I not know this about you, Adam? How have we not talked about the fact that neither of us watch sports?
We haven't talked about that ever?
No. I didn't know that about you, actually.
Oh, that's God, really, I'm a wicked no sports ball guy.
Oh, that's funny.
I fake it.
I actually skipped the Super Bowl this year. That's actually...
So did I. I was playing Starfield on Xbox.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I had an excuse because I was taking care of my wife who was recovering from COVID, but I was definitely playing Baldur's Gate 3 all day.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Instead of watching the Super Bowl.
Super Bowl. What is that thing you talk about where he goes, that's the Patriots earning it, does not exist. No, that was a Family Guy quote. But no, I'm not a sports ball guy. Never have been, never will be. It's funny, too. I come from a family of sports ball people.
Oh, my mom is the biggest fan you'll ever see. Every December, she prints off the bowl schedule so that she can highlight which team she's going to root for, and she watches every game if she can, every single bowl game.
That's crazy. About as crazy as my one of my best friends, Eric, who besides having the Patriots logo tattooed on his back,
wow,
when they won the Super Bowl in 2001, the 9/11 year was very emotional. Now, I'm not, there's a bad thing, but let's face the facts, Patriots, and I got this from Eric, is America's team. They are red, white, and blue.
It was originally the Cowboys, though. The Patriots like to think they are, but the Cowboys were America's team. I heard that.
See, look at us talking about sports, Jack.
Yeah, Well, the thing is, I grew up in a sports family. I know all the sports facts. I actually know probably more rules about football and how the game is played than most people, but I don't watch it.
Baseball I grew for me, up, that's my family.
I mean, pre-2000s, sorry, Patriots, the Cowboys were America's team. They were first America's team.
We were second, and Patriots were second America's team. But I had never seen this guy cry, and this guy is not a crier. He's kind of a tough guy, bawling like a baby. Oh, the Patriots won! Oh, my God. The tears, like he had just had his child. I was like, dude, you okay?
So speaking of storytelling, there are a number of people listening who are going to be like, yeah, I identify with that story because I've been there. Let me tell you my sports story where I got emotional about it. This is such a normalized thing that this is the reason why you've probably, I mean, we worked together. How many sports analogies would I tell?
Zero.
Thinking back.
None.
A lot. No, I would tell a lot of sports analogies, actually. Because it's the analogies that people relate to, right?
Yeah.
Sports and cars. You talk about sports, you talk about cars. People can relate to both. Even if you're not a car person, you've had a car and you had car problems. So I talk about cars and car analogies, and I talk about sports and sports analogies, even though I don't watch sports, because it draws people in instantly. They've all been, whether or not they're a sports person, you, Adam, as well, have been to watch sports with people.
Oh, so, yeah. I've been to baseball games, football games.
Totally. And so you've got stories about those times, and you'll relate to a sports analogy.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody does. It's a very universal, relatable thing. And so from a speaking about stories perspective, it's interesting because it's just there's always a sports story, even if you're not a sports person. Back to why we first got on this rant, you were about to tell a sports story, even though you're not a sports guy, to which I go, everyone should tell sports stories, especially if they're not sports people. But right. Maybe research first. Maybe research it first so you're not talking about doing a grand slam in bowling, right? It's just not.
Yeah, I worked in a bowling alley for years.
Grand slams are reserved for baseball and tennis. So, yeah.
I didn't know a grand slam was in tennis.
That's winning the three top tournaments. We could ask Ron specifically which ones is considered the grand slam.
Oh. Well, that's you learn something new every day.
Yeah. Ron, if you're listening, comment, let us know which three. Thank you.
Yes. and this one is another one that I got really excited about in the book. And I'm just bringing it back here because I think this is neat. Once upon a time, a young man left his glasses on an airplane. He tried to buy new glasses, but the glasses were expensive. And if you watch us on YouTube, you all know that Jack and I both wear glasses. Why is it so hard to buy stylish glasses without spending a fortune on them? He wondered. He returned to school and told his friends why he should start a company selling amazing glasses for non-insane prices. We should make shopping glasses fun. We should distribute a pair to someone in need for every pair sold. Eureka. Warby Parker. That's how it was founded and born.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cool story. It has, and you know the success of it, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. So that I thought was a really neat, and that gets into the one of the breakdowns that she gets into, and that's the founder's idea. So this is a founder story. This is a story that, and if we relate it back to business in particular, it's a story that can help you in a sense that it's a setup. It's a verification of we're a real entity. It's a lot of small things, but used at the right time, it can deliver a very powerful message.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't help but thinking as I was reading through that, like, how would most people have told the Warby Parker story, which is glasses are really expensive. And so we set up a system by which you could have a monthly subscription to get your glasses at really cheap, affordable prices. And compared to a competition, you know, Luxottica, who owns all the, I mean, you're already not paying attention, right? Because that's not a story. That's just me talking at length to you. But yeah, I think I agree. Definitely because everyone's, if you wear glasses, you've left them someplace, you've lost them, you've broken them, and then dealt with, crap, now I have to spend, like, my insurance isn't up. How do I get these glasses in a more affordable way? Like, we've all been there. And that's, again, it's back to that, like, kind of normalization of it. I love it.
And glasses ain't cheap, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something that I thought about as well with what kind of that story is. Like, I think about that founder story. If I'm sitting down to listen to someone pitch to me how their company got started, I'm usually preparing for a pretty hefty lesson on an industry, right?
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, great, someone's going to be, if it's about a glasses company, someone's going to be talking to me about how glasses are made and why they're so expensive and the difficulties with insurance. I'm sitting here going, I'm about to be given a lesson. But that founder story does not require critical thinking in any way, and I'm bought in.
Yeah.
And that's something that Kendra talks about actually pretty early on, talking about how to make a more persuasive message. And she talks a little bit about the idea of like a level one versus level two thinking. And that when you get to level two is where you're getting into having to think more critically about things versus a level one thinking, which is like the things you can do automatically without like breathing, right? You know, you know how to walk, you know how to type. That's level one level thinking stuff. And that storytelling will reduce the cognitive strain involved in listening to someone talk, keeping you in that level one as long as possible. And that's what a really good founder story will do, which is help me understand your company without making my brain have to work in overdrive.
Right. And save the brain power for when you actually want them to pay attention to the demo.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And when it gets more complicated, when it has to get more complicated, there's no way to do it. But at least you've gotten them for a lot further down the road in the level one thinking. So last thing I wanted to talk about actually is a story of mine from when I was in middle school. So I had to do this. It's probably honestly like probably a 2-minute speech, but it seemed like it was going to be like the longest speech I'd ever given in my life. Right.
Oh,
I was in seventh grade doing anything. Speaking is like so much stress. And so I had to do this like biography. I remember it was a biography about Henry Ford. I had to do all the research and write down this speech. I was going to get up and present it. And it was a competition. So there was a lot of like, I want to win and give the best speech, et cetera. And you had to kind of get into a character of somebody, et cetera. And I had practiced this thing like multiple times a day for weeks on end leading up to this thing. I knew every word memorized. I could like in my sleep, I've been talking about Henry Ford and Model Ts and all this stuff like that. And the moving assembly line that he did and how that revolutionized the industry, the you know, manufacturing forever, all this stuff. But I knew it so well that what happened was I stood up in front of the teachers who were grading. Seventh grade, very intimidating to do this. I stand up. So I'm really nervous and I'm focusing on not messing up. I just launch in. I launch in and I'm doing the thing I've practiced a million times before. And about maybe 4 minutes in of my 2-minute speech, I recognize I found a loop that I didn't realize existed where I was ending a paragraph and I was looping back to an early part of the speech going back through probably a couple paragraphs and then looping back to the previous point. I was in an endless cycle. What had happened was I had perfected my speech so well that I'd lost sight of what I was talking about. And I was able to make mistakes. Now, even if I hadn't made the mistake, because Kendra actually tells a very similar story about this, is towards the end of the book, where she had practiced something so much that the meaning of why she was telling the story was lost. That's what had happened. I lost the meaning of why was I saying what I was saying.
Right.
She says that practice breaks perfect. And I 100% agree with storytelling. If you practice so much, you'll lose sight of what your message was. And actually, this is something that I recently actually gave a speech at Demo Fest, which was fantastic. I really appreciated doing that. It was a lot of fun. But I reached a point when I actually tell myself, I have to stop practicing now. I've got the message down. And if I practice anymore, I'm going to forget why I'm saying the things that I'm saying. And I'm going to find myself in that endless loop over and over and over again. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Oh, agree. That's a really good point and a really valuable lesson because, I mean, we're all of that group that we may just want to dive in and practice more and more and more. And I'm going to get this right. I'm going to get this right. And we're just shooting ourselves in the foot to a degree.
Yeah.
Leave a little room for breathing.
Absolutely. Leave a room for you to keep it real. Keep the story live. And don't ever, if you're always telling the story the same way, you probably overpractice it. It's time to change it up.
Yep. Exactly.
All right, that's it for Adam and my conversation about stories that stick. Next week, we're going to have Maddie Stremick, who you may know from her time when she was with the Pre-Sales Academy. Now she is with her own company called Better Career. She's going to be joining us for two episodes next and the one after that. So definitely make sure you're following so you can see that as well. Like I said before, demojockeys.com, like we always tell you. You can also find our LinkedIn page, which is appropriately named Demo Jockeys, so you can come find it all there. Absolutely. Love to see it. Before we end for this week, Adam, what do you got for us in the demo zone?
Yes, let's kick it over to the demo zone, and we're going to actually do something interesting now, and that is we're going to kick it over to a demo jockey who has sent us in a tip. Curtis Barber, let's kick it over to Curtis and let's see a tip from the community.
Hey, demo jockeys. I just wanted to share my tip and trick. If you ever have to share a slide deck during a call, but you don't want it, a lot of AEs do this where it's like literally in edit mode and it's super ugly. They don't want to do it full screen because they want to have Slack open, something like that. One quick way to make it full screen in the tab that you're going to be is if you go over here to where it says edit, and it has a slide number. If you just put in present, it's going to then load it in full screen where you can easily click into it, but still be able to have it available for you and be able to utilize that in your demos. Thanks.
All right, folks. That was actually from, again, someone right on, another fellow demo jockey right from our own Slack community, Curtis Barber. Thank you again for that excellent tip. We liked it so much, we wanted to share it with you. And hey, everyone out there, if you want to get your tip or your trick that you use that makes your life better, that you think you could help maybe some of your fellow demo jockey brethren out there, we would love to see it. Go ahead and submit that via just a simple clip like you saw earlier with Curtis, and maybe you'll even make it on the show. Be fun.
Yeah, absolutely love it. Thanks again, Curtis, and thank you everyone for listening. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.